This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 1st of April 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 77th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Now, it's Easter time in my corner of the world, maybe in yours too. Even if not, we want to give you a bit of that vibe, all about renewal, rebirth, fecundity, stuff springing right up at you. We here at Culture HQ want to provide you with a fresh, grass-green array of cultural treats for you to enjoy alongside your massive chocolate eggs, your minted lamb, your thoughts of fluffy chicks. We go southbound to London's National Theatre, where a brand new bright red box caught our eye. It's called The Shed, and we'll ask what it's doing down on the bank of the Thames.
It has been, I think, a real bolt of energy and excitement throughout the whole of the organisation, the fact that we've got this temporary chance just to sort of let collective hair down a little and do something different.
We'll hear from our man in Milan on what was selling like hot cross buns and what was exciting editors at Bologna's Children's Book Fair.
Pushing with his mighty blade, Bulldozer works to smooth the grade. He clears the way to level ground and fills the air with thunderous sound.
We'll also pop over to Paris to hear why a French filmmaker has chosen to make that most tricksy and untelegenic of mediums, radio, into a much fancied documentary hit.
Radio France and this building are very important. Many, many millions of people listen every day. It is our something we have in common.
Plus, we'll head to Mexico to attend a festival where old and new cultures collide. Boom! We'll hear about a multimedia thing in New York which reflects on the war in Iraq through the eyes of award-winning journalists. And as ever, we'll pepper this artsy showcase with some music too. This week, a session from London's own The Leisure Society. That little lot is all to come here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. So let's get straight into this week's Midori House session. The Leisure Society are a British band who've been known to sneak onto the Monocle 24 playlist from time to time with their upbeat summertime indie. Their new album, Alone Aboard the Ark, is out this week, recorded on a 1970s mixing desk using 2-inch tape. No less. Ever a fan of the analogue, we invited the six-strung band into Midori House to perform what they described as an acoustic session, but what we call a pretty much full-scale toe-tapping musical spectacular. From it, this is their first single, Fight for Everyone.
We say by the ring of the bell, is it hard to relax when you're told that you can never feel? Has the bit that you spit from your teeth been replaced by a taste that has all but lost its novelty? You don't need to change, you just need fire and a little faith. In order to get what you want done, you must fight for everyone. To what you needed, you spent time on nothing much. And a moral is you live and learn. There's a barb in your heart and a world on which we turn. And it's easy to see what you mean when you say life's a train and it's slowly rolling over me. You don't need to change, you just need fire and a little faith. In order to get what you want done, you must fight for everyone. To what you needed, you spent time on nothing much. Thank you. to get to what you needed. You spent time on nothing much. And a moral is you live and learn.
That was Fight for Everyone, and as per, we'll have a little bit more from the Leisure Society and their smile-inducing Midori House session later on in the show. Before we head over to Bologna, we're staying a little closer to home. Katie and I hopped the Bakerloo line to London's South Bank to investigate what on earth a big red box was suddenly doing snuck in under one of the National Theatre's concrete armpits. Well, it turns out it's a theatre too. A little red rooster of a temporary structure called, disarmingly, The Shed, that's been built to house productions that might have taken the stage at the mid-refurb Cottesloe, the little of the National Theatre's spaces. I met up with Steve Tompkins, director of Howarth Tompkins Architects, who were behind the project on a cold and windy spring morning down on London's South Bank, to see what's in his shed.
The South Bank is completely monochrome at this time of year, so it suddenly struck us that it has a beautiful blast of intense colour. It would warm the cockles of everyone's hearts walking along the South Bank as they came past, highly visible from across the river. There's also a reference to Norwegian barns, they're painted this colour, this incredible deep red colour. And against a sort of tundra landscape, that was a little subliminal reference for us. And another one, of course, is the constructivists, who loved red. And it's a beautiful, brutalist concrete environment. And it kind of goes well with that sort of palette of materials.
I wanted to ask you about restrictions of a temporary building. Aren't always restrictions, are they? Always, Steve. I guess there's a sense that building within a sort of temporary framework actually sets you free in a way.
It can be incredibly liberating because you work fast, you have to move very quickly through the design process. You know the building isn't going to be there forever. And so it's more like a production design in some ways, the way that the set designers work. And because it's holding theatrical productions, because actors and directors are going to come in and use it, there's a really lovely sort of fluid connection between the fabric of the building and the fabric of the production, which you don't often get in permanent buildings.
It's one of these things, temporary structures. People always fall in love with temporary structures, don't they? And then when it's time for them to go, when the Cottesloe is renovated, maybe, yeah, people will maybe have a tear in their eye. Most of all, you, possibly, Steve. How long are we going to be looking at the shed on the South Bank?
It'll be about a year. We'll be working on the Cottesloe, soon to be the Dorfman. And when that opens in about a year, then the shed will go and we'll finish off the overall landscaping works around the National, in about a year's time. But I never shed a tear when these things go. I think it's great that they're just there for a short time, and there's the intensity of the experience, there's the memory afterwards. So the project never really goes away, because I think it changes your perception of a place when a project like this has happened. And one of the reasons why I think Nick Heitner was very keen that this project was on site and not walk about somewhere else is that it actually adds to the richness and the density of the building even after the shed has gone.
Smells good in here, isn't it? Smell of
raw plywood.
Raw plywood, yeah, exactly.
Delicious.
It's obviously got a very stripped down, pared down look. I guess we're in the cafe right now, in the foyer.
Yeah, we're in the new foyer, and what we've done is really just close in and commandeer some of the Lasden overhead concrete walkways, which normally give out onto Theatre Square externally. And to do that, we've just taken out a little bit of the ground floor glazing from the Littleton foyer. So eventually, when the theatre opens, this will all be part of the main front of house. But obviously the language is very different, and hopefully the idea is it'll attract a different crowd of people, different audiences that maybe aren't habitually part of the National Theatre scene. And the same thing applies to the programme of productions, really. It's not the usual fare, so it is designed to be more experimental, perhaps a bit more groundbreaking, perhaps a bit more adventurous, and just really trying to extend the programme of the National and extend the sorts of audiences that are going to come in and enjoy it, both for now but also to come back when the building is finished beyond a year's time.
I suppose the act of putting an extension on, a temporary extension on the National Theatre, frees up the artistic, the creative, the writing, the playing that goes on inside the building as well. It's an interesting idea that the materials, the dimensions and the temporary nature of the building free up the creative spirit inside it, right?
Yeah, it's fascinating, and it's a really interesting conversation, because it has been, I think, a real bolt of energy and excitement throughout the whole of the organisation, the fact that we've got this you know, this temporary chance just to sort of let collective hair down a little and do something different. But I think that energy will feed back now into the final project, and a lot of the things that we're trying to do is to make the building overall more porous, more accessible, more open, both to the changing environment of the city around it, because, boy, has this part of the world changed so much over the last 40 years since the building was built, but also the way people come to the theatre, the sorts of audiences, what they expect of an evening at the theatre has radically changed as well. So I guess our work is really bringing this amazing masterpiece of a building up to speed, up to date, without losing the essence of what it is.
And what's it like working, as you say, we're in the arena of raw plywood, Steve, jutting up against these famous concrete, brutal angles of the National Theatre. What's the meeting of minds between the two materials, for example?
Well, it's interesting because Dennis Lazen always imagined this building as a kind of armature for other activities, more temporary things going on around it, rather like, I don't know, a temporary fair forming outside the walls of a castle or a market stall or these sorts of things. So, you know, this temporary wooden language does very beautifully, I think, live alongside the permanent masonry, yeah. This almost geological structure of the building. I mean, you'd never want to build a temporary extension to ape the architecture of the National, but I hope what we've tried to do is make a building which has kind of got a serious dialogue. It's not just a temporary pop-up jokey sort of thing, and you know, we like to think it has got a serious architectural relationship with the building, and it's asking questions of the National, and hopefully the National is answering back.
Well, let's walk inside the auditorium, shall we? Tell us how many seats are we looking at in here? It's quite a Donmar-ish space.
Well, yeah, and quite a sort of younger sibling of the Young Vic as well. It's got the same sort of thrust format, three-sided stage. It's about an 8-metre cube of playing space, which is beautiful proportion, I think, for the human body, surrounded by this sea of faces. Yeah, and it's a very simple, quite Cottesloe-like structure, fairly raw, darkish painted, but it's still got the warmth of rusty metal, which we made the steel frame of the building out of. Plywood panels, as you say, which aren't painted black, but are just stained down, so you've still got some of the warmth of the wood, and that just gives you that little bit of humanity in what might otherwise be a cold space.
I wonder what the reaction was to the director and to any of the productions that are warming up to come on stage here. People enjoy clicking their heels on these boards already.
Yeah, what's been great is that we've had the chance to conceive and develop the design with the directors and performers and designers that are actually going to be making the season. We know who they are, we can talk to them, they're all in the building for the most part. So it's been an unusual privilege to actually brainstorm the final form of the building with the people that are going to be completing the experience and making the work in it.
Just finally, when the time's right for the first standing ovation in here, do you know what it's going to sound like? Have you had a full house of echoing, clapping hands in it?
We had the first full house this morning at a staff meeting, and there were a few tears in the eye, I can tell you. And I'm hoping it's going to be an amazing, intense, beautiful theatrical experience.
That was Steve Tompkins, director of Howarth Tompkins Architects, talking to me about The Shed, which opens to the public next week on the 9th of April. For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, where we're heading over to Italy now to sample a little bit of literature for little people. No, not the highbrow Booker Prize sort, but novels devoted to vampires and wizards and stories about farm animals and fairy princesses. Each year, Bologna hosts its annual children's book fair, the world's biggest. It's where publishing houses big and small auction off the rights to bestsellers, and where budding authors and illustrators hope to attract attention. We dispatched Monocle's Milan correspondent Ivan Cavallo to crack open a few spines, book spines, he's not a violent man, and see what young readers can expect on the bookshelves in the coming months.
Sales of adult fiction might be in a slump, thanks to e-books and the economic crisis. But at the Bologna Book Fair, publishers of children's literature were bullish on the future of print. Tracy Phillips sells the rights to kids' books for Simon & Schuster.
Picture books are going extremely well at the moment, and we're doing particularly well in Latin America. There's a big demand, sort of government-funded picture books in Latin America. So where some European markets are really suffering, obviously the economic crisis is hitting many people. So our business is slightly down in Spain and Portugal and Italy, but it's booming in Brazil and Chile and other Latin American countries. I find a straight ebook, a digital version of these books, is a poor substitute for an interactive game. If you want to be interactive, then there are plenty of creative companies who are adding music and digital effects. If you want a story that you can snuggle up with in bed or, you know, show on an airplane, then nothing really beats the book. You can kind of shove it in a suitcase, it's very portable. And there's something about the size. You can have a lot of impact from the sort of texture of the paper. And of course, this is just straight picture books. We're also selling books with touch and feel and pop-ups. And there's something about the physicality of the book that really can't quite be replaced by digital.
Young adult fiction was another hot topic. Bloomsbury, the publisher behind Harry Potter, was looking to find another blockbuster among the many manuscripts proposed by authors and literary agents. Bloomsbury managing director, Emma Hopkin.
There seems to be a real trend in sci-fi and also in witches, which is quite interesting because of the enormous interest in paranormal publishing with Stephanie Meyer back 5-6 years ago. We're seeing this real resurgence in witches at the moment.
And what about for the little kids?
For the little kids, we see there's an awful lot of illustrators at the fair as well, which is really interesting, showing their work to publishers. And at the moment, we're seeing a lot of young fiction with highly integrated illustration, which I think, again, is the success of Wimpy Kid has shown that maybe that middle grade audience really like illustration involved in their fiction as well.
Illustrators, including Stephen Guarnaccia, were also out in droves, pitching their ideas to publishers.
I'd liken the difference between the children's book market in Europe, say, to that in America, to the difference between, say, the Hollywood film system and the independent film system. Kids' books and kids' book illustration is really market-driven in the United States. And it's partly because the market is so huge and the possibility of creating, you know, mega bestsellers is so great that the editors and publishers and librarians drive what gets written and illustrated. In Europe, I think it's really much more an artist-driven culture. And so, therefore, it's a little more experimental. I think the market actually follows the artists and where the artists are going. The editors respond to new ideas that they see in the portfolios that they get presented to them, you know, minute by minute at this fair, for instance.
One company looking to promote creativity is Italy's Coraini, an art gallery and publisher from Mantua, known for its imaginative kids' titles. Coraini's Giovanna Balin.
So as a Coraini, I think we cannot be considered just the usual children publishing. We've been working with some designer that have never been involved on the children publication and has never thought before to do it. So we like the idea that they have to make a new challenge by their own. So like Marty Guiget is a quite famous international designer, and we asked her to do some books with him for children. He has done something like drawing books, like last is the cake book, is the blank book, where the children can really play on it. Obviously it's a kind of book that is great for children, but we have also adults, so most of the cases our book, they buy two copies of each book. One is for children and one for their own. They keep it away from the children.
Can you just explain some of his books, like what the concepts are, a couple of the ones that he did for you?
The first book was the blank book. So you have just a blank book completely, and they have to fill it up. So yeah, the children have to play, they have to draw on it, and write if they want it. So completely free.
Are there any instructions at all in the book?
No, not at all.
So
no.
Completely free form?
Free form.
So what, here it's about color and texture, paper
yeah.
Stock?
San Francisco's Chronicle Books, which picked up an award at Bologna, took the more traditional route. Johan Almquist reads from Goodnight, Goodnight Construction Site, the publisher's popular illustrated bedtime story about work trucks.
pushing with his mighty blade, Bulldozer works to smooth the grade. He clears the way to level ground and fills the air with thunderous sound. No one's as tough and strong as he, but now he's sleepy as can be. He puffs some smoke out of his stack, turns off his engine, stops his track. He curls into his soft dirt bed and dreams of busy days ahead. Shh, good night, Bulldozer, good night.
And so this has been a bestseller, this construction site book.
Yes, it's been now over 70 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. It's been the number one 16 times. It's still up there on number two. And we've sold it to 16 languages and counting, which is a record for us for a children's book.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Up next, we'll hear how you make a film about radio.
Taiwan's southern port of Kaohsiung is the topic of our latest Monocle film. Once a neglected sibling to Taipei, we visit a city attempting to balance industry with livability.
Kaohsiung is most intriguing in that it's no post-industrial town searching for a new reason to be. Rather than move beyond its industrial roots, Kaohsiung is aiming to show that it can sculpt a city that people want to live in without sacrificing its role as the industrial heart of Taiwan.
Taiwan, turning the tide on Monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where we head now to Paris. Now, the medium of radio might sound like an unusual topic and a logistical nightmare for a filmmaker, but that's exactly the challenge that French director Nicolas Philibert set himself with his latest project, Maison de la Radio. This documentary film takes you on a journey to the heart of Radio France's vast and iconic Paris headquarters. Given the film's rapturous reception at the recent Berlin Film Festival, we decided to send Monocle's Paris correspondent, Tom Burgess-Watson, to meet Philibert and find out how he went about taking the viewer into this invisible universe of sound.
Maintenant, il n'y a plus d'avion, Fini.
The idea was to plunge the viewers into this world of voices, accent, through a huge range of programs. In Radio France, you have radio fiction, of course, the news, interviews of all kinds. You have programs about, architecture, philosophy, all kinds. I wanted to propose a sort of journey into this hive of activity.
Beaucoup de questions sur le rôle joué par Twitter, par Internet, par les médias en général.
What was perhaps for you the most enormous challenge in this entire project?
The biggest difficulty is linked to my own desire, my own appetite. In this huge building, you have like 60 studios, and here you have an orchestra playing, there a jazz pianist rehearsing, here political discussion, etc., etc. A painter, a writer, many interesting people, many interesting activities, and some days I wanted to film everything, here, there, etc. So I had to contain my own appetite and oblige myself to slow down, because it's totally useless to accumulate hours and hours of film. It was difficult, but it was mostly a great pleasure to make this film.
Weren't you a little bit intimidated by the idea of making a film about voices and radio? Wasn't that a great challenge for you?
Yes, because the radio is an invisible media. So it's a strange idea to make a film about radio. One of the reasons why I love radio is linked to this invisibility. When we are listening radio, we are free to imagine the faces of people who are speaking in the radio. We are free to imagine the places where the radio program took us, etc. And it was a big challenge. How to make a film about radio without destroy the mystery of radio?
Question signée
Eliane Haupt de Saône-et-Loire. Pour faire face à la pénurie, à la fin du mois d'août de l'an dernier, on a construit au Havre une centaine de logements pour étudiants. Quelles particularités ont-ils ?
Did you find that you were making it up as you went along? Was it quite spontaneous, the direction the film take, or had you really mapped it out beforehand?
It was mostly improvised. First, I love to improvise. I don't like to prepare too much in advance. Very often, I say before starting a film, the less I know about the subject, the better I feel. I don't like to know too much about. I like to invent the film day after day. And when you make a film like this one in this big radio company, of course you don't know in advance what is happening, who will be invited in the studios to tomorrow or day after tomorrow, because we don't know the news in advance, you know. So I had to improvise and I liked it. Radio France and this building are very important. Many millions of people listen every day. It is our something we have in common, and it deserves to be in the center of Paris.
That was director Nicolas Philibert talking to Monocle's Tom Burgess Watson. Coming up next, we're going to tell you what's coming up next. Still to come in part two, we'll enjoy some more of that lovely pastoral session from the Leisure Society. You can definitely imagine lambs gambolling across fields to that. We'll hear what happens when international pop music meets indigenous Totonac Mexican traditions at the Cumbre Tajín Festival. Not sure how Easter-tastic that is. And we'll reflect on the 10th anniversary of the war in Iraq with a multimedia exhibition at the Bronx Documentary Centre in New York. Well, rebirth, maybe. Time first, then, for a bit more of this week's Midori House session. From their new album, Alone Aboard the Ark, this is the Leisure Society with Forever Shall We Wait.
In silence we shall sit, contemplating everything, the world and how it came to be, alone aboard the ark. The same thoughts every night, bathing cold fluorescent light. If this is it, then what a ride, wake me when it's true. To have it all and seize the day, to go where no one else dares stray. Forever shall we wait. In light of developments, I suggest we start again. The 9 to 5, the 6 till 10, I've swallowed every urge, but it makes no difference when all your money goes on rent. The never-ending arguments to be put off and on, to have a place to call our own, to shun the old familiar road. Forever shall we wait. These arms are heavy, these feet are raw, I cannot walk, but I can crawl into the arms of another monster lurking somewhere deep inside. My mind set on the blink, I missed it from the kitchen sink. Regret the days you didn't glimpse a spark amid the mire, invading every scene. A welcome to the working week, a place to hide until we leave, to dream perchance to sleep, to grease the corridors of youth. I let them tell me what to do, I won't do that again. These arms are heavy, these feet are raw, I cannot walk, but I can crawl into the arms of another monster lurking somewhere deep inside. Deep inside. Deep inside.
Thank you.
That was the Leisure Society with Forever Shall We Wait. And after making the whole of Midori House tap their feet along to such a wonderful session, culture producer Katie Bilboa sat down with Nick Hemming and Christian Hardy from the band to hear how Sylvia Plath and the Ivor Novello Awards helped play a role in forming the sound for their new album.
Now, the new album's about to come out, Alone Aboard the Ark. Tell me about that. Why is it called Alone Aboard the Ark?
It was a lyric from a song. Originally, the album was called something else, so it was a kind of last-minute decision. But the title that I'd been kind of working with for years, suddenly everyone was like, it's very negative, so we decided to change it to something. Well, I was going to say uplifting, but Alone Aboard the Ark isn't uplifting, is it?
The difference is this one has a sort of romanticism, and like our music, it could be seen as quite a dark thing, but there's also something quite romantic and beautiful about being alone on the ark. Whereas the other one, which we shan't repeat, it was just could be seen as negative, and I think that's the difference. Like, there's an optimism to Alone Aboard the Ark that I quite like.
Well, I guess the ark is sailing forward to a land of hope.
Yeah, it's a lyric from a song, and the lyric meaning in the song is it was a song about working a day job that you really hate, and because I was working in a warehouse when I started writing it, and being in this really busy environment, completely surrounded by people, really bustling, but just sitting there feeling completely alone. So that's where the genesis of it. But
and out there, you said this is one of the songs you played was about Sylvia Plath, and I understand that she's been quite a big influence on this album.
She has, not so much the album, to be honest, but on that specific song, definitely. I was just reading a lot of her poetry, and then I started writing this song, and I wrote a line, the first line of the song, and I didn't really know what it was about. It's just one of those things that came out subconsciously, and it just had the rhythm of it was kind of similar to her writing. So I thought, So I just did a bit of research on her life and listened to some old radio interviews and wrote the song kind of about her.
So tell me about the genesis of the group. You guys know each other from back in Burton-on-Trent, which for those of our international listeners, we should say is in the West Midlands. How has that area kind of fed into your music?
Well, it was a kind of lot. We kind of knew, we were acquaintances before we were friends, really. We were playing in different bands, and there was a bit of kind of rivalry there, I think, wasn't there? Particularly between the singer out of the band you were in. But yeah, we had a mutual friend who kind of got us together in a room to play together. And 5 years later, Christian was looking for a guitarist for his band, and I was at a birthday party of my ex-girlfriend, who I just split up from a long-term relationship and moved out of the house, and I was pretty depressed and just had no direction in life. I was doing a job I hated, and Christian said, "Well, you've got nothing to lose. Why don't you move down to London and sleep on my sofa?" And I did. So I just left the job like the next week and moved down to London and spent quite a few months sleeping on their sofa until the other housemates got sick of me. And so I ended up sleeping in Christian's bed, which was tiny in a little tiny room.
I'm just picturing the scene, sorry.
Yeah.
Don't know what to say.
It was lovely, really, in a non-sexual
way. I'm quite moved,
way.
Yeah.
The only thing to do to cover the awkward, embarrassed silences was sing together. So we ended up working on a load of Nick's songs and working out how to harmonise our voices. And from that bizarre, slightly homoerotic beginning came the Leisure Society. And we started gigging, and then Nick got the Ivor Novello nomination, and off we jolly well went.
So, how has that affected, what you've been able to do? How has that impacted on what you've been doing, that award nomination?
It was, it was very strange, because I didn't realise because when somebody suggested that I put it forward for the award, because it had been getting lots of radio play from people like Guy Garvey and Mark Radcliffe, Lauren Laverne, and everyone was talking about it.
And like, we should point out for our listeners overseas that these are very respected music.
They are, yes.
Journalists and music broadcasters in the UK.
Exactly, yeah. And they didn't just play it, they talked about it afterwards, so it obviously touched their hearts a little bit. So it's obviously got some kind of magic. But sent it off, didn't really expect anything, then got a letter through the post a few weeks later saying you've been nominated, and we just kind of assumed that loads of people got nominated every year. It's like, wow, that's nice. And then found out it was 3 records every year get nominated for this award, and then the press got hold of it, and it became a big news story because I was working in a warehouse at the time. So I'd get like news at 10 coming to film me wrapping a pallet in a warehouse and things like that. And ITN, I went to the Houses of Parliament to do a live interview from their studios, and it was very strange. Even got a Sun headline, a tabloid headline.
Oh, wow, what
me.
Was that?
It was, "Ivor not got a clue who he is either," which I was quite proud of. So that was all a bit strange. It was exciting, and it kind of forced me to get over my shyness a bit. And then it became not exactly a millstone, but it was like I got a bit sick of talking about it after a few months. But now it's a nice thing, because we've kind of had a career after that. So we're into our third album now, so now it's like it's just a really nice thing to look back on, and it was kind of once in a lifetime experience.
That was Nick Hemming and Christian Hardy from the Leisure Society. They're talking to Katie Bilbauer. And the new album, Alone Aboard the Ark, is out this week. They're playing the Bazaar Festival in Antwerp on Saturday before embarking on a UK tour with other European dates coming up in May. Just go to theleisuresociety.co.uk for more details. And we'll have one more track to finish off the show from the Leisure Society at the end. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, where we cross now to Mexico. Last week, the Cumbre Tajín Festival on the country's east coast wrapped up its 14th edition. Inspired by European events like WOMAD, it was intended as a one-off back in 2000. Now, people from far and wide flock to this unique festival. It celebrates the region's indigenous heritage with thousands of activities, combined with a distinctly popular musical lineup on the main stage. We sent Frederick Bernas to examine this intriguing culture clash.
A nombre de todos ustedes.
The sacred city of El Tajín is buzzing with mystical energy. On the stroke of midnight, people start shuffling around in concentric circles, dressed all in white, carrying candles, flowers, and even a dead chicken. Behind them, an ancient pyramid glows blue. Incense drifts through the air. The Totonac people are requesting the blessing of their gods for the Cumbre Tajín Festival of Identity, a five-day event that happens every March. Along with a huge selection of indigenous activities, the festival features mainstream musical acts like Calvin Harris. Here we go!
I'm sure it works, because we get united by the art.
That's Salomon Bazbaz Lapidus, director of Cumbre Tajín. In the early days, he says it was difficult to balance these seemingly conflicted agendas, but now they have a sneaky strategy.
These great international artists are a good... people come to see them. They move masses of people. But what we want is a little bit to use them so people can come, and they're coming for a concert, and suddenly they found a whole cultural richness. And when they leave, they change their whole image of the indigenous people.
At this workshop, visitors get to make bamboo flutes. It's a key instrument in traditional Totonac dances, which are performed regularly during the festival. Musicians often play a small drum at the same time. In a hut at the center of the festival park, Totonac elders pray three times every day. Although Spanish invaders imposed Catholicism on the Totonacs 500 years ago, these services are not what you see in European churches.
In the end, we have one thing that nobody else has in Mexico, which is a living culture.
Brenda Tubia is general producer of the festival. She thinks many Mexicans don't truly appreciate their heritage.
If you go to Teotihuacan, for example, you can talk to an Aztec. But if you're here, you can talk to the Totonacs. You can sit down with them, learn from them, and that's huge. And I don't think a lot of people realize that until they're here.
Mexican acts also play the main stage. You're listening to Sistema Bomb, a new group mixing electro, hip-hop, and reggae with jarocho and other traditional styles.
This situation in Cumbre Tajín is exactly and direct the consequence of the big, big indigenous movement in Mexico.
That's vocalist Rocco Pachucote,
The more evident explosion of this voice is since 1994 with the struggle of the Zapatistas in Chiapas. I think from that moment, Mexico changed deeply and profound. So from that moment, I think many levels of society, of Mexican society, start to be more conscious about the real importance of our roots.
Brenda Tubia hopes that international artists also engage with these issues. This year, the Smashing Pumpkins frontman, Billy Corgan, led by example.
Smashing was a really good surprise for me. Billy was here for almost the entire festival. He walked around, he went to the pyramids. They had a meeting with the elders in the Cantillan, and they were really into the culture and what we do here in the social part of the festival, which is really what I look for when I book an artist. I want them to be involved with what we do, more than just coming, have a show, play for 2 hours, and then leave, and then never talk or think about the festival ever again.
Sometimes the collision between popular and traditional culture felt a little awkward. American influence dominates the globalized generation of today, and I wondered how many of Regina Spektor's screaming teenage fans were interested in ancient rituals. But Cumbre Tajín doesn't stop when the festival is finished. 30% of ticket revenue is donated to scholarships for indigenous college students, and the park hosts educational programs all year round. This innovative preservation model has been recognized by UNESCO. It's clear that the Totonaca community always comes first. At a time when many fear that Mexico is forgetting its own history, Cumbre Tajín is striving to keep that culture alive. For Monocle in Tajín, Mexico, I'm Frederick Burness.
And thank you to Frederick, who we believe may still be lost in a forest making bamboo flutes and performing totemic dances. What can I say? He just got into it. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. We're after this short break. We're heading to New York.
If you're looking for great Monocle content on your smartphone or tablet device, download the Monocle app today. We'll bring you the daily monocolumn bulletin with fresh opinions from our editors, the essential 2525 city guide to the best business cities and resorts, and the full Monocle 24 radio experience with our time shift player, so you can catch up on any shows you may have missed. Download our Monocle app today for your smartphone or tablet. Monocle. Keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. And we end this week's show in New York, where a new exhibition has just opened at the Bronx Documentary Center. Invasion, Diaries and Memories of War in Iraq presents three different experiences of the war from within the same unit. The war diaries of Marine Lieutenant Timothy McLaughlin and award-winning work by journalist Peter Maas and photographer Gary Knight. All three men witnessed the toppling of Saddam Hussein's statue in April 2003, and it was Tim McLaughlin's American flag that was draped around it in front of a global TV audience. The multimedia exhibition marks the 10th anniversary of the invasion, and reporter Pauline Eiferman headed to the Bronx to find out more.
In 2003, Peter Maas and Gary Knight rented cars in Kuwait City and entered Iraq as unilateral journalists. When they realized the war zone was too dangerous, they attached themselves to a Marine Corps battalion that was heading to Baghdad. Shortly after, they witnessed what became one of the most memorable moments of the invasion. The Marines draping a statue of Saddam Hussein with an American flag before taking it down. The image stayed in Peter's mind for years.
Several years later, around 2008, I got the idea in my head, decided to start doing it, reconstruct the toppling of the statue of Saddam Hussein and the placement of the flag on top of it. Even though I was there, even though Gary was there, we just had our little, you know, straw-sized view and understanding of what happened, why they went to Firdaus Square, whose decision it was to take down the statue, what reasons the statue was taken down for, the flag, where did it come from, whose flag was it all stage-managed, all of that stuff. And so in the course of kind of doing the reporting and the research for that, I wanted to find the guy whose flag it was that was put up there.
This is when Peter met Lieutenant Tim McLaughlin. But the ex-Marine, now a lawyer in Boston, had kept something that turned out to be more interesting.
I got in touch with him, arranged to get together, we get together, get to know each other. And then he says, you know, by the way, I've got these diaries. And I open them, and sand falls out. I mean, he has not opened these diaries since 2003. I read them, and I'm just stunned by them. I'm just like, these things are more important and more interesting than the flag.
Peter showed the diaries to his photographer friend, Gary Knight, who instantly thought of creating an exhibition around them.
When I looked at these, I thought, wow, this is a wholly different view of this war than mine and than Peter's. One, and that's really stimulating. And two, visually, they're fantastic, as you can see. And I had the scans made and then made a couple of big prints and sent them to Peter. And he agreed, I think, when we both looked at them, that they were just really fabulous objects. As well as being, you know, a very different narrative of the war, right? I think, you know, we've discussed this, Peter and I, a number of times. The narrative of this war is sort of owned by politicians and certain media, but media often that wasn't there. Media that viewed this war from a hotel room or from editing screens back in New York or in London or Paris. And I think this whole exhibition really is about eyewitnesses.
The exhibition on show at the Bronx Documentary Center in New York brings together three perspectives of the invasion within the same unit: a reporter, a photographer, and a soldier.
The items that are here on this entire wall are a selection of pages from my diary. The diary is probably 70 pages long. It won't all fit on this wall. So we selected pages that are representative of the whole. So there's some probably bad poetry over there, and there's what it's like sitting waiting to go over here. There are lists of people who I interacted with. There's stories of killing people, killing the right people, killing the wrong people.
That's Tim McLaughlin, the author of the 36 pages of personal musings displayed on poster-sized scans in the gallery. This is the entry dated April 7th, 2003.
I woke up on the east side of the Diyala Canal, still just outside of Baghdad. The first thing to do was to get the mechanic to repair the O-ring and the hydraulics on my tank. It seemed safe at that point. No one was shooting at me. Then artillery started falling. First, I thought it was friendly artillery, but it was getting close, like less than 50 meters. My driver and I were on the outside of the tank while it was getting fixed, and we pressed up against it. I don't know why I wasn't more concerned. I should have been. Zing, zing, boom, like wham, on the other side of the tank. Then one of the rounds hit about 150 meters to my left and destroyed the Amtrak and the crew of three. It was a direct hit. Lots of grunts on the outside and the building in front of it, but somehow none others were hurt.
The same attack is described in Peter Maas's New York Times article, hanging on a panel a few steps away, and portrayed in Gary Knight's photographs, displayed on the opposite wall. But another element in the gallery disrupts this idea of eyewitness account. Looping videos show an official version of events giving to the American people.
When you walk into the gallery, you will see on the wall Colin Powell giving his somewhat now famous speech to the UN, saying Saddam Hussein definitely had weapons of mass destruction. One of the ideas behind doing that is to bring people back to that moment, which actually, when you look at this stuff now, everybody will have their own reaction. Mine was, it seems almost surreal, just that, you know, these things were said and this was presented as the best information and the true information, and that this was the way the war was presented. It just takes you back in time, which is important because I think for a lot of people that already is a receding memory, and it should not be a receding memory, I don't think.
But many have already put a rock wall behind them. When Peter and Gary approached art museums in the city, they quickly found that the world had moved on.
We contacted museums and galleries and said, hey, we've got this idea, we've got this material, are you interested? And the response was universally, no, if we even got that far.
If we got an answer.
It was no. For all kinds of, sometimes reasons were stated. And the most consistent one would just be like, it's a rock, it's history, you know, we've heard all we want to hear about it.
It's really fascinating because really now, you know, the attention that this show is getting is extraordinary, you know, and we're pretty much turning people away. And I think that the galleries and the museums missed a trick. They didn't really understand how interested people would be in this different perspective. How else are people going to mark this anniversary? This is a huge event in contemporary world history, let alone American history. Obviously, people are really interested in it. I was really surprised. I couldn't believe it. But hey, you know, these guys were brave enough. This is a fantastic space, and it's inside a community. And it's a community that I dare say has a lot of veterans in it.
These guys are the people behind the Bronx Documentary Center, a sunlit gallery on 151st Street, which opened 2 years ago. It's a non-profit space devoted to documentary projects, located in an area of New York where the art world generally doesn't set foot. And it's the only place that agreed to host the exhibition. But as the team were putting the final touches on the show on the eve of the opening, they prepared for a large crowd. Museums didn't understand how interested people would be, says Peter Maas. Seeing how much attention it's getting now, it seems that many are finally ready to revisit the events that followed March 19th, 2003. For Monocle, in New York, I'm Pauline Eiferman.
And if you'd like to see that exhibition for yourself, Invasion, Diaries and Memories of War in Iraq, it's on at the Bronx Documentary Center until the 19th of April. And that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll have changed our show into a six-hour football phone-in extravaganza. Only joking. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. The show is produced by the killer team of Katie Bilboa and Holly Fisher. Time for one final song this week from their Midori House session. This is the Leisure Society with another Sunday song. Thanks for tuning in.
So what's in the back of your little red book? And why do you smile when you know I'm done? There's bait on the air and a lazy old sun to keep the heat in every inkling. A forest fire of sideways thinking. The tricks I'll try a thousand times to wrestle down the wind. You fade in the haze of the opening row. I fought for you once, but I must let go. 'Cause how many years can you keep this hope? Too many other cats are craving. They're polishing their claws and saying, in 15 words, what took me is to hang my name upon. Crowd float the eyes as you rip it east long over Yellowstone cliffs to the holy love. You seize this disease till you're all used up, consoling every unpaid artist. The chance to finish what they started. Another Sunday song.
Thank you.